stalking, following, and harassing another person repeatedly. It became a crime in Iowa in the 1990s, but it's difficult to prosecute since in many ways, stalking is an invisible crime. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We talk criminal stalking this hour. 6.6 million people in the U.S. are stalked every year, and increasingly, cyber stalking is part of the picture. In the first half hour, we hear from an Iowa woman who was stalked for decades, also a stalking victims advocate, and John Turbett of Iowa's Division of Criminal Investigation. Have you been stalked? Tell us how it started, how you reacted, and what you did to stop it. That coming up, first this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stalking, that's repeated following and harassing of another person over the course of days, weeks, even decades, as we'll hear later in the program. It became a crime here in Iowa in the 1990s, but it's often difficult to prosecute since in many ways stalking is an invisible crime. We talk criminal stalking this hour. An estimated 6.6 million people in the U.S. are stalked every year, and increasingly, cyberstalking is part of the picture. In a few minutes, we'll talk with a stalking victims advocate. Later in the hour, John Turbett of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation will be with us. He trains law enforcement around the state on how to respond to victims of stalking and how to investigate cases of stalking. And we'd like to reach out to you this hour. Perhaps you've been stalked. Won't you tell us how it started, how you reacted, and what you did to stop it? 1-866-780-9100. Personal stories of being stalked. 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to write us an email instead, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email, or we're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us to begin the hour is a victim of stalking. Kathy Niebel is with us. She joins us in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you today?
I am doing well. I hope you're doing well. You have unfortunately been stalked for almost three decades, as I understand it, since the mid-1980s. Tell us how it started and what set it off. This is your former husband, your ex-husband.
Correct. It actually started as I was informed. He was an officer in the military, and I was informed by the battalion commander that he had defrauded the government and was serving as an officer even though he never graduated from college. And given that information, I took our children and moved back to Iowa.
You were living in California at the time, I believe, right?
Correct. Fort Irwin, California. And shortly after, we filed for divorce, and that was quite a process in itself. And to be honest, in the early years, I wouldn't have even used the term stalking or known what that was. I just thought it was an angry man that was unhappy about a divorce and was acting in very strange and dangerous ways. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately when our separation occurred, things began, phone calls hour after hour, beating on the windows at night, taking plates off my car, license plates, coming to my employer, threatening to blow up the building, those types of things. And again, I just dismissed it as someone very angry and you know, going through a difficult time. Sad to say, to this date, we're still dealing with some issues with him in very different ways.
Mm-hmm. They're very, very. Let's talk about the early days, if we could, and then mm-hmm. move on a little bit. Like the big difference between repeatedly calling you, banging on windows, and threatening to blow up your place of work. At what point did you get law enforcement involved in there? This is in California still, right?
Or no, back no, in Iowa? I had moved back to Iowa.
Okay.
Almost immediately, law enforcement was involved, although they didn't take it very serious. Most of the time they'd say, well, what's the big deal? You know, he took the plates off your car. I got a temporary restraining order very early on, which really meant nothing to him. The phone calls, you know, I'd call the police and they'd say, well, it's not like he's really going to hurt you. You know,
so what police department is this?
Des Moines Police, Urbandale Police.
Mm-hmm. In the mid-1980s?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
And part of it was very frustrating to me. I grew up somewhat maybe naive that if you followed the law and followed the rules, you know, justice prevails, if you'd say. And I was so frustrated why they wouldn't take it serious. I was afraid. I would tell them, I'm afraid he's going to hurt me or my children. And they kind of were very dismissive.
What did they say exactly?
Well, you know, like one, it was a threat left on my answering machine and I played it for the policeman and he said, oh, come on, it's not like he's really going to kill you. Those types of responses. The day he took the plates off my car, he was sitting directly across the street with him in his arms. I knew he would wait for the police. And when the police came, the policeman said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, first of all, I'd like my plates back so I can use my vehicle. And I said, I also think it demonstrates he's definitely been on my property, which violates the no contact order. So he went over and got the plates and handed them to me. And he said, well, you know, next time if you have a problem, maybe you should just handcuff him to the railing. Those types of responses.
Incredible.
There was a lot of dismissal of the seriousness of it. They would kind of joke about it, you know, make fun of my concerns or my fears. So that was really difficult because I constantly felt like I was being re-victimized again by
sure.
others. So it was a tough time.
The children involved, threats to your children?
My daughter – our daughter actually had to continue visitation with him, and she came back injured one time with a broken collarbone we discovered later on at the hospital. So DHS became involved at that point. He never really had much interaction with my son that was from my first marriage, and I didn't know till years later why that was. It got to a point where there would be a policeman every other Friday, a social worker from DHS videotaping and documenting the attempt to have visitation. And she would refuse. She reverted back to very toddler-like behaviors, cry, scream. She would not sleep at night. She was wetting her pants, those types of behaviors.
Sure.
So, you know, I would say on average we had police involvement probably 4 to 6 times a week. And then each visitation. He never really physically made threats to her, but he was doing things, obviously, that were bringing her harm.
Bring us more into the present. Your ex-husband has been, what I understand, incarcerated a number of times?
A couple times. And he's a 2-time convicted felon on unrelated charges now. And there were a number of charges pending in Florida, and we just found out that those have all been dismissed. And the explanation was that they just have bigger cases to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 of those were repeat domestic violence and repeat aggravated stalking, breaking and entering, and a well-occupied and an assault charge, which is consistent with what the experts have told me that as time passes, he would have to escalate his behavior to get the same type of needs met.
We'll talk about that a little bit with some
sure.
of our other guests later. Kathy Niebel is my guest. If you've just joined us, stalked for over 28 years by her ex-husband. We're purposely not mentioning the ex-husband's name, hoping that gets a little bit more safety for us in talking about it for Kathy as well. And tell us, it's really hard for someone not to having been stalked. I'm sure this is distressing to hear from my perspective, having not been stalked. Give us a little idea of the stress and anxiety. Help us understand more precisely how it turns your life completely upside down. I don't imagine how you can go to work, how you can sleep, how you can relax at all.
In the early years and the middle years were most difficult. I always tell people it's paralyzing fear 24 hours a day. I would go to sleep eventually, and then when I'd wake up, I was in fear. If we heard a noise during the night, my children slept with me. Oh, for probably the first 10 years, to try to move about was extremely frightening. If I would leave the house, then I would be afraid to come back in the house because there'd be things left on the door. Several times there were bloody animal parts hanging on my front door, those types of things. But then when I got in the house, I was afraid also. You know, the I had windows broken out during the middle of the night, those types of things. So it is a constant state of fear. And to a point, I said it was very paralyzing. There's also anger, sadness. I felt at one point I spent a couple years grieving the loss of who I was before. The Kathy that I was gone. And even to this day, there's parts of me I can't get back. And that's difficult. As a mother, the most difficult, painful part was seeing what it was doing to my children and trying to keep a positive light on things and trying to keep them going to school when they need to and those types of things. As far as employers, same thing. I move about very differently in this world, even to this day. I don't move about like most people do. An example, in the morning, I don't think many people probably have to think about this, but my goal is each morning when I'm ready to leave, I have all my work items, and I have to be in my vehicle where I can crouch down in the vehicle before the garage door completely opens. And that's going to sound silly to some people, but I always feel if I'm in my vehicle and he was outside waiting with a gun, at least I have the car around me to protect me. So mentally, that's how I start my day each day. Before I go leave work for work, I set up props and different things around my house. So very quickly, if I come in the house, I can see visually before I even take two steps in the house, I can see if somebody's been in there and disturbed things. I do the same thing at bedtime before bed. I go through a little ritual where I leave a cupboard door open 6 inches, or I leave a book on the stairs open or closed, certain things that I know if I get up or am woke up during the night and these things are moved, then I know that I'm in danger or in trouble.
Kathy Niebel, thank you so much for being with us to give us a firsthand account of this. And please do stand by.
Sure.
I want to introduce Kirsten Faisal, also in our Des Moines studio, Director of Training and Technical Assistance at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, based in Des Moines. Kirsten, you're there. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. You're sitting there next to Kathy there, this incredible story that we're all listening to, certainly an extreme example, I mean, over decades of extreme stalking, threatening. Back up a little bit, because stalking doesn't have to go nearly this far to be criminal stalking, does it? How do you define it, and where is that line?
Well, the line, it does not have to be nearly that extensive, and typically it's not. Typically, you're talking about a couple of years, I think is about the average. The line varies from state to state. In Iowa, the line is defined in our criminal codes. It is a course of conduct that is purposefully engaged in to make somebody be in fear, reasonable fear, that they will be injured or killed. And the person who is engaging in that behavior knows that they're putting that person in fear, and they do it on two or more occasions. Those are essentially the elements of stalking in Iowa.
When I listen to Kathy's story, Kirsten, I, from the mid-1980s especially, the reaction of the police there in Urbandale and Des Moines, I'm just dumbfounded. Has that changed? Has that changed? I can't believe that's what we expect of our law enforcement.
That has changed significantly. I mean, you are talking about a time when stalking was not even against the law. We know a whole lot more now. There have been numerous efforts, even ongoing right at the moment, to change law enforcement response, to change the way prosecutors view these cases, the way victim advocates view these cases, to develop new strategies to help keep people safer, and ultimately then also to figure out what can we do to change the behavior of stalkers so they don't continue to terrorize anybody.
Let's go there. Let's understand that perspective. What is the goal of a stalker, or are there several possible goals?
There's several goals, and sometimes they engage in those goals simultaneously or switch very quickly between them. Typically, a stalker, most stalking is from somebody that the person knows. Often it's an intimate partner or former intimate partner, not unlike Kathy's situation. In that, hers is very, very typical. So one of their goals is often reconciliation. I want to get this person, or I want to get them back, stay in a relationship with them. So to keep or regain a relationship, that's a major goal for many stalkers.
By making them so uncomfortable that they wish for a former life, so to speak.
Yeah, pretty much. I will make this so bad that you will have no choice but to be in a relationship with me, to stay with me, or to come back to me.
Okay, another possible goal?
Vindication. I want to show the world that I am the one that is being victimized here. I'm the one that's been injured. I am the good person. They are the bad person. With that, you might see a lot of attempts to destroy the other person's reputation. This stalkers often have a sense that they are the victimized party. And, you know, I can't speak to Kathy's husband or what he thinks, but my guess would be that he saw himself as the one who had been hurt by this divorce, and that she was creating all of this, and she was the only one who could stop it by stopping the divorce or by coming back to the relationship.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, what is your best guess as to your former husband's goals here?
Well, I think Kristen explained it very, very well, and that is that he carries a list on his body at all times of everyone that has victimized him, and those are attorneys, newspaper reporters, policemen, clergy, my parents. I'm number one on the list. And he stood in court in 1987 in front of the judge and said, "I will never, ever stop until she's destroyed." And I think it is clearly exactly what Kirsten said, is that I took away his only child. And I also removed us from our marriage. He fought 2 years to get that divorce before it was finally final. Mm-hmm. And so I think she's exactly right. I can only guess from what he's done and his actions have shown. But it's like, if I can't have our daughter and I can't have you back, then, you know, I'll do everything I can to see that you're destroyed. And he did vocalize that in court. So.
And this man is of that opinion today, and he's a free man?
He is a free man, and I think he is of that opinion today. Most recent actions, he sent 20 postcards over a month of pictures of us and pictures from when we were married, and he's telling our daughter what these pictures stand for, which she already knows. And it's as though he was kind of going back, reminiscing. He sent a calendar to my daughter at her place of employment that was photographs of all of us as a little family unit, one of those that you can have a photograph of each month. And all 12 months, it was like we were still a little family unit, had our wedding anniversary date on it, those types of things, which indicate to me and others that have looked at it that he just is still of the mind that we're going to be together or are together. It's difficult for me to accept and understand. And when you receive something like that, most people would look at that and go, "Well, what's the big deal? It's a calendar with these photographs." It was extremely frightening to me and our daughter because it symbolizes something that isn't. And if that is his mindset, it frightens me that he still is clinging on to that idea that we still belong together. And it's – so sometimes these things look very subtle and just look very okay, but to the victim, they're terrifying.
Kathy Niebel is with us. She continues to be stalked by her ex-husband on nearly 30 years, 28 years, and we're talking also with stalking victims advocate Kirsten Faisal, Director of Training and Technical Assistance at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, based in Des Moines. We're reaching out to you, our listeners. Have you been stalked? Not to the degree that Kathy is, most hopefully, but to tell us how it started. Perhaps you think you're being stalked and don't know. You'd like to share that. You can also share it anonymously. 1-866-780-9100. Tell us how the stalking started, how you reacted, what you did to stop it. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Kathy, you've mentioned the danger that you've been in all this time, and some may ask, well, why do you go to the media? Why do you perhaps put yourself in even more danger by being on this program today?
Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, I guess I'm the eternal optimist and always hoping that when we know better, we can do better. And it's been part of my healing process, for one thing. I've also gotten feedback as I've spoke around the country from others that say, thank you for speaking out because you're my voice. I can't. And the fact that you are helps all of us. Also, I just think that I'm almost safer, not safer, but I jokingly say when I speak publicly out at conferences and things is that if anything should happen to me now, a lot of people know who to look at. So I know that's not all that funny, but it does mean to me that the people know. People have often said, why do you stay? Why do you stay where you are? He knows where you live. He knows your place of employment. I have built a safety net around me, if you will, by staying where I'm at. The police response has improved tremendously. The county attorney's office, the lawyers, the county attorney. I mean, there's just so many people that know of this situation that it helps me to feel a bit safer. If I was to remove myself and go elsewhere, I would have to try to establish that. And
right. Tell your story again to all the law enforcement and get that net of security around you.
Absolutely.
Established. And yeah. It sounds like he would be able to find you. He's quite capable of.
He's found us anywhere we've been. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a safety. And then people recently have said, why aren't you pursuing him? Why aren't you filing charges against him? And that's a very good question. The reason we're not currently is we are unable to secure right where he's at this time. And secondly, I don't want to stir the pot. I know I could hold him accountable, but I can't take that risk. By doing that right now, let's say filing the stalking charges for these postcards I've received, it just ups the ante. It will provoke him to do even more. He's shown that over the last 28 years.
Stalking victims advocate Kirsten Faisal, tell us, what is the appropriate action to take here? Of course, confronting your stalker has some risk here. All different types of situations. What should one do if one believes you are being stalked?
There is no Band-Aid answer. Certainly, what I tell victims is that they are the expert on their particular stalker. So, you know, in Kathy's case, she's saying that if I were to get a restraining order, do something, that would escalate him. For some people, that they are going to say that exact thing to me. Anything I do to make that person feel more victimized, they're just going to take it that one step further.
Will law enforcement respect your opinion if you say you know your stalker, don't do that? If the police wants to do something, will they respect that and go your way, or will they? I imagine some victims of stalking will say, if I go to the police, I'm going to set a whole chain reaction of things off that will set him off, or, you know, if it's a her, shut her off in a way that I know is predictable. They just don't know him like I do.
Stalking is a mandatory arrest in Iowa, which would mean that if law enforcement arrive on the scene and they have probable cause to believe that stalking has occurred, then the code does require them to make an arrest of that person.
Mm-hmm. We'll get into this in the second half hour if you can stay with us. Sorry, Kirsten Faisal, in fact, Special Agent John Turbutt of the Iowa's Department of Criminal Investigation, we hope he will be joining us later in the hour, talking about stalking this hour with Kirsten Faisal of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence based in Des Moines. Kathy Niebel, stalking victim, and we hope to hear from our listeners with your stories of being stalked, how it started, how you reacted, what you did to stop. If you have questions about whether you are presently being stalked, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. When we come back, cyber stalking. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about stalking in just a minute, cyber stalking, that dimension, a scary new dimension of stalking. An estimated 6.6 million people in the U.S. are stalked every year, and cyber stalking, a part of that picture. We'll hear about that in just a moment. It only became a crime in Iowa in the 1990s. We're talking with Kathy Niebel, hearing her amazing story. Distressing story of us being a stalking victim for 28 years, stalked by her ex-husband. Also with us, Kirsten Faisal, Director of Training and Technical Assistance at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic violence based in Des Moines. We want to go quickly to our phone lines to talk to a few people. We've reached out to you, our listeners, to ask if you've been stalked and to have you tell us perhaps quickly, briefly, what that was about, how it started, what you've done about it. Anna, you are in Des Moines. You have been a victim of a stalker.
Yeah, I had a stalker for a much shorter period of time, but I felt really scared, and I connected a lot with what Kathy said.
Mm-hmm. What specifically did your stalker do? A man?
Yeah, it was a man, and he would come into my workplace multiple times a day, every single day for like three or four weeks. And finally, my bosses were there, and they were able to kick him out.
Did you previously have a closer relationship with him, or did he come out of the blue as a stranger?
He came out of the blue, actually, but he acted like we had a long history. It was really strange.
So this, So your employer actually ended it with one conversation with him, or what happened?
He made a big scary scene, though, when he was asked to leave. He made a mess and shouted and cussed at all of us. And yeah, but he hasn't come back, so.
Mm-hmm. Any law enforcement involved?
Not yet.
When did this happen?
If he comes back, I'm supposed to call.
When did this happen, Anna?
Just a month ago, actually.
Wow, really?
Was when he last came. But yeah, I definitely feel differently about being alone now. I look over my shoulder a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Kirsten, do you have some words for Anna while we have her on the line briefly?
I think what it shows from her story is how important other people can be in helping to contain some of these situations. Having her employer step in and say no so that she's not alone. I mean, Kathy referred to creating this support system and the safety net, and employers can play a really important role in doing that, helping to vary their employees' work schedule, workplace security issues, having somebody escort Anna to her car after work. There's all kinds of things where employers can try and at least maintain a safer workspace that can be really helpful for people in these situations. And it certainly is not uncommon, whether it's what it sounds like a stranger stalking in Anna's case, or an acquaintance or a friend or former partner stalking, to have those behaviors come into the workplace. I mean, even if that stalker doesn't know where you live, doesn't know where you have run to, one place they can always find you is your workplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's that first step I'm reading about stalking is they inform themselves very intimately about all the details of where your comings and goings and where you hang out, all that stuff.
Absolutely. They want to gather information. Again, if I have information, I can figure out ways to convince you. I can figure out ways to scare you. I can figure out things I can use against you, how to blackmail you, how to guilt you, any kind of information they can gather. That's a very typical stalking behavior.
Anna, thank you for sharing your story, and we hope you don't have that problem at all anymore. Thank you for sharing, though, Anna in Des Moines.
Thanks.
Nathan is with us. Nathan, I see you're on the road on my screen. What's your story?
Yes. I actually had a breakup, and, I had some stalking tendencies myself. I ended up sending some threatening text messages to my ex and some threatening emails. I've ceased all contact with this, but I really did feel the victimized end. I felt like your guys' description of a stalker, which was kind of scary.
Mm-hmm. So, first of all, thank you for coming forward, Nathan. I don't think a lot of people would come forward and admit they had stalking tendencies. And when did you catch yourself and say, either figuratively or really, look in the mirror and say, "Wait, what am I doing?"
I think more than anything, I finally realized that the other person had moved on, and that there was nothing I was going to do to get them back through guilt or anger or kindness or anything. And that was kind of a weight off my shoulders to be able to move on. And kind of, yeah, that was the end of it.
Nathan, thank you for joining us on the road. Nathan dialed 1-866-780-9100. This is a nice way to get to Linda Krohn, who's with us in our Iowa City studio, director at the Women's Resource and Advocacy Center at the University of Iowa. Linda Krohn, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We wanted to, was talking about texting there. Nathan talked about his threatening behavior being in texts there. And you are someone who did an assessment at the University of Iowa campus. As our digital age changes every facet of our life, why would it not change stalking? Of course, there is something called cyber stalking. When did you first notice it happening here on the University of Iowa campus?
Well, part of my role on the campus is to receive confidential reports from students, faculty, and staff who are experiencing any kind of harassment or violence or intimidation. And I was starting to hear a pattern in the folks who came to me, particularly among students, that part of the medium in which this unwelcome behavior was occurring was online or through technology, getting 20 texts an hour from someone that they've asked to stop. Having someone post unwanted messages on their Facebook page or impersonate them on Facebook and put unwanted things out there. Some listeners may remember the Tyler Clementi case at Rutgers University, where a roommate turned on a webcam on a laptop computer in the dorm room and recorded images of his roommate and then shared those. All those kinds of uses of technology are going on. So much of our lives is occurring in virtual spaces. So it's not unexpected that unwanted behavior would occur there as well.
Can you name the first year that you would have said, oh, I remember that as the first cyber stalking case I looked into at the University of Iowa or received a complaint about?
Well, I came into my role in 2009, and it started very quickly after that. I started in my current position with my responsibilities in June of that year, and I'm sure I had one the first month of the fall semester.
With what frequency do you handle those now? How many students are coming to just you? And I'm sure that's not everybody that's experiencing
Certainly.
It.
Certainly. Yeah, I'm only one of several places where students can bring those concerns. And I get at least one a month personally. And then a lot of consultation with other units across campus, probably stemming from the work that I did doing a campus-wide needs assessment and doing some training for other units around campus to develop response protocols.
You've listed a couple ways that stalkers use technology. Are there others you haven't mentioned that, of course, technology is evolving, the landscape changing, so it's cat and mouse, isn't it?
It really is. You know, I do presentations around the campus, and I say that every time I do it, I have to make a new PowerPoint because there's some new technology or technologies or some new app that has been invented. And it's not that the app itself is necessarily designed for ill purpose. It's that it gets used that way.
Right.
So mobile devices are certainly a huge concern these days. Any mobile device that accesses the internet is a potential vulnerability for a cyber stalker to gain access and then to either monitor a person's location, to intercept their communications, to send them unwanted communications, to issue threats, to impersonate them in virtual space. Any number of things like that. And often these monitorings or surveillance don't become apparent to the victim immediately. It's part of that information gathering that we were talking about earlier that stalkers do.
Here's a scenario that I heard. I wonder if it is part of stalking or a tool, a weapon, I guess you'd have to say. After a breakup, Linda, a couple breaks up, perhaps there have been some intimate photos, some intimate videos, and one partner gets those and puts them out anonymously or without a trail on the web, and that certainly fits our definition of trying to destroy the other person, doesn't it?
Right. Often what's involved in sort of that vengeful phase can be a sort of attempt to malign or destroy the other person's character or reputation, to share information about that person that may have been confided or shared in the context of a more intimate connection that would not want to, that person would not want made public. And that's embarrassing. It can be damaging to the person's professional or academic progress, and personally is very frightening.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100. A lot of response by phone. Julia is with us, also on the road. Hi, Julia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. Go ahead, please.
I had an experience back, and this is again back in the late 80s, so I know that she said the laws had changed since then. But I had worked as a volunteer at an inpatient psych unit as a college student. And somehow one of the people who was in care there got my name, and all he had was my name, but he proceeded to stalk me for the next several years and seemed to be able to track me wherever I went, even when I moved out of state. And I got to the point where he would call my parents' home, and I would, of course, they knew that this gentleman was out there, and so they wouldn't give him any information. But it went so far as him contacting me when I moved to Arizona from Iowa. And he used to send me a lot of boxes of things, letters describing our relationship, and then he would say things that would be scolding me about things that I had done and things that indicated to me that he knew something about me or that he had been observing me.
Right. And how did you react? How did you end it? I hope it has ended.
You know, it ended, and I don't know why it ended other than the fact that I know that what put him in the psych ward in the first place was because he was stalking another woman, and he came to her residence and he was arrested. So at the time, I was just told, you know, I would tell him to leave me alone, and he would not leave me alone, and I told the police, and they basically told me, well, until he shows up on your doorstep, there's really nothing that we can do. But for some reason, at one point, I was married, and he called our residence in Arizona, and my husband got on the phone and basically told him, you know, she's married now, you need to leave her alone, and he's never contacted me since.
Okay. Thank you for sharing your story, Julia. We hope that doesn't happen. Julia joining us from On the Road, 1-866-780-9100. I want to make sure that we talk with John Turbitt is with us, special agent with Iowa's Department of Criminal Investigation in the Major Crime Unit. John, you're joining us by phone. Are you there?
I am. Thanks for letting me be part of this.
Hey, John, thank you for being with us, special agent John Turbitt. You've been listening to the conversation, I think, most of the hour. Tell us what your involvement at the DCI is, at the Major Crime Unit, in regard to stalking is.
You bet. Our job as the DCI is to come alongside local police departments and county sheriff's office on a number of cases, and some of those involve stalking behavior. So we're seeing this in different jurisdictions and in different towns all over the state and get to be involved in helping these victims.
Okay, so how do you specifically do that? You train local law enforcement, but you also investigate stalking.
Yes, I am a plainclothes detective, so I'm very much involved in investigation, and every once in a while I do get the opportunity to train officers and well in how to investigate these things.
Mm-hmm. When you are investigating a stalking, what's the first thing you do? You talk to the alleged victim of the stalking, and what do you want to ascertain?
Well, you've hit the nail on the head. For Iowa officers, we are really making an effort to stress the value of that initial contact with the victim, and we want them to know that we trust them and believe them, and we're going to work hard to get to the truth. And then we begin to work together to do that task of putting together a timeline of the stalking incidents, and that really comes largely from our victim, at least initially, and allows us to jumpstart that investigation.
Well, yeah, I don't know if you were with us when Kathy Niebel told her story from the 1980s. It seems like such a sea change. Kathy Niebel there, if you were hearing, you know, playing recordings of her stalker, her ex-husband, about with death threats and being told, don't worry about it, Ms. Niebel. That has to have changed significantly.
It has changed a lot.
John, and then let's do get to Kirsten after that. John Turbitt, tell us.
Yeah, very disheartening to hear those things. And I certainly think the landscape has changed in Iowa law enforcement. I am out working with a number of officers, and I know they're dedicated, and we have worked really hard to become victim-centered when it comes to these crimes.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, so when someone would be out there listening now to call law enforcement about that, I want to make sure that they're not going to get Kathy Niebel's treatment, and you can reassure them that they will be listened to and taken seriously.
Well, absolutely. That's certainly my goal, and I know it's the goal of the officers I work with in Iowa. And that is absolutely what we need to be doing. And it takes effort on both parts because we don't want to paint with a broad brush and bring in any bad experiences that we've had in the past. And we ask that victims come in and give law enforcement an opportunity to help them in these situations.
Kathy Niebel, you wanted to join in there. Please tell us.
Yeah, I was going to say in the early years, it was really difficult, and I felt re-victimized. The last several years, I've seen a really extremely good positive change. In fact, with the Johnston police, it was at the request of one of the lieutenants that had looked over my court documents and my papers, and he said, you know, we haven't done a good enough job, and we're going to start a roundtable. So we have a roundtable approach now on my case where we bring in the Urbandale Police, Des Moines Police, Johnston Police, Professor Frank from Drake Law Clinic, a person from the county attorney's office. And anytime I have a concern, we come together and we discuss what options, what we need to do, what each party can bring to that, bring to the table. That, to me, was huge to know that they had offered to set something like that up. And it tells me, like what John said, is that law enforcement's taking a very, very different approach. And it's personally very heartwarming for me to know that they listen and they understand the seriousness of this from the victim's perspective.
John Turbitt, can you give us a quick outline of the possible remedies that someone who is you can offer potential victims from a law enforcement perspective?
You bet. We want to encourage those victims to get in and talk to their local law enforcement and get that initial report on file. And, you know, we encourage both them and with the help of the police to let that person know that that's unwanted contact. And from there, you start to look at the possibility of criminal charges and no contact orders. And we're teaching officers to be smarter about this now and to realize when we're looking at a stalking situation. In the past, we've sometimes dismissed some of these as petty offenses when we see the phone harassment or the criminal trespass or the vandalism, and now we're teaching officers to look at those in their totality and say, wow, I'm looking at stalking, and that's how I need to really pursue this for this victim.
Right, and I wonder if our popular culture here is in part at fault here. How many love stories have we heard in you know, acquaintances or friends where it goes something like this, the woman usually turns down the man's advances again, again, and again until she finally sees the light. And his persistence, his not giving up means, oh, it must be true love. Now, there are certainly happy couples out there, many, many, who can tell some version of that story. How do we know the difference there when it's stalking and when it's admiration or love? I don't know. What do you think, Kathy?
To me, the one big difference is if you feel fearful or afraid of that person, that to me isn't love. Love should never feel frightening or scary. And if somebody approached me and I indicated to them that I'm not interested and they continue to pursue that to a point where you're afraid or feel fearful, then you certainly, you know, that to me is unwanted behavior, and that becomes stalking as opposed to someone that just really admires me.
Linda Crone, anything to add on that briefly on that note?
I would agree. The difference there is where you cross the line into fear. And I do think that our popular culture has romanticized the storyline you described in some ways that are really unhelpful to us in interpreting these behaviors appropriately.
John Turbitt, I wanted to make a quick aside with you, if I could, because we've had in our news a man suspected of abducting two girls from a bus stop in central Iowa in Dayton has been found dead, but there's still a massive search for one of the girls, Kathleen Shepherd. Now, I understand you're joining us from a scene that has something to do with that. Where are you, if you can tell us?
That's right. I'm right near north central Iowa area, and I'm working with just a tremendous number of local, county, state, and federal officers to find that young lady.
Okay, so tell us again, so our listeners can know, especially in central Iowa, what to be looking out for, a red Toyota Tundra?
That's correct. That's right. Exactly. And I think a press release just went out that I had heard aired on your channel, and that is, in fact, we are looking for that, as well as the description of the young lady that was put out.
What else can you tell us? What are you searching for besides that? I mean, obviously the young woman.
Yes, we are looking for the young woman and some of her articles of clothing and things that that we believe that she had with her at that time. Really anything that will help us find her, and we are praying and hoping and working as quickly as possible that we find her in a good place.
Okay, Special Agent John Turbitt, will let you get back to that. And please, do you have a number on hand that people can call with any information or way to get a hold of you?
You can certainly, if you look on our website, the Department, Iowa Department of Public Safety, there is a number to our headquarters that you could call, and I would encourage you to do that.
Okay. Thank you very much, John, Special Agent John Turbitt of the Department of Criminal Investigation, Iowa's Department of Criminal Investigation. We'll almost come to the close here. I want to reach out quickly and ask if what needs to change Linda Crone, maybe I can leave you with this last question. What needs to change still in our culture or law that can improve, eliminate to the degree that we can stalking? Very quickly, sorry.
Culturally, we need a big change around understanding when no means no and when it's time to stop contacting someone who has cut off, who has ended a relationship or doesn't desire one. That's a huge thing. And I would say legally we are having trouble keeping up with the advances of technology. And I think it's a real challenge for investigators as well to keep up with that technological change.
Okay. Linda Crone, thank you very much, of the Women's Resource and Advocacy Center at the University of Iowa. Kirsten Faisal at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, based in Des Moines. Thank you for joining us, Kirsten.
Thank you.
Kathy Niebel, thank you most of all for telling us your horrendous story of being a stalking victim. We wish you all the best. Thank you for coming forward with that.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
River to River is produced by Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton's. Technical support today from Dennis Reese. Also help in Des Moines from John Pemble. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us for Politics Wednesday tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.